The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show, our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. Okay, my friends, there are so many misunderstandings regarding the recent overturning of Roe versus Wade. Misunderstandings as to exactly what the law now is, misunderstandings of exactly which justice voted which way, also a lot of downright lies coming from the left as they seek political advancement, and of course, as always, many sincere people who believe the lies. Today, I will expose the lies and also clear up the misunderstanding. We'll begin with the misunderstandings. First, there were, for all intents and purposes, two votes taken by the Supreme Court. One of them had to do with Dobbs versus Jackson. That was a case that came up through the courts regarding a Mississippi law that put limits on abortion, substantial limits, banning most abortions after 15 weeks. This Mississippi law, which had been challenged, was upheld by the Supreme Court in a vote of 6-3. Justice Alito wrote the majority opinion. Writing a separate concurrence opinion, Chief Justice Roberts, while stating that he agreed with Mississippi, also said he felt this latest ruling by the Supreme Court went too far and that Roe versus Wade should not have been overturned. This is typical behavior for Roberts, who seems to pride himself on being a moderate. Unfortunately, moderate in his mind means sometimes siding with the right, sometimes siding with the left. So, by Roberts not joining the majority opinion, the vote was 6-3 to uphold Mississippi, but 5-4 to overturn Roe versus Wade. We are hearing a lot of nonsense by the left that this will affect other rights of privacy, such as contraceptives. Nancy Pelosi gave a speech claiming that very concern. Her speech shamelessly ignored Alito's clear language that was crystal clear. Alito made it abundantly clear that this ruling had to do with abortion and only abortion. He could not possibly have made his language any plainer. Nancy Pelosi knew this, but Nancy Pelosi is a lying politician. Now, some will point to a separate opinion written by Justice Thomas, who says we should now also reconsider other cases such as same-sex marriage, cases such as contraception. Okay, let me dispel those concerns first. Thomas is only questioning how certain rights were arrived at by the 14th Amendment, like they were with Roe versus Wade rulings, and he believes all such laws should be made by the states, not the court. This is not a commentary on the merits of such laws. Second, Thomas is just one man. His opinion is only that, opinion. It is what Alito wrote in the majority opinion which stands. Conflating Thomas with Alito is deceptive. It leads to lies. Speaking of lies, as I said, there are many lies associated with this subject. Let me go through them one at a time. Lie. Abortion was just made illegal in America. No, abortion was not made illegal. Neither did the Supreme Court make any kind of ruling on the rights of the unborn. All they did was decide that laws about abortion should be decided through democracy and legislature. They returned abortion decisions to the states where it once was and where it truly belongs. Anyone in our country who wants an abortion can still get one because it will still be legal in many states. And the states where it's going to be legal are really stepping it up. They're going to make it legal on steroids. California is talking about becoming a sanctuary state for people that want abortions. My friends, I don't say this happily. If things were my way, abortion would be illegal everywhere. That doesn't mean I want to see women who have abortions go to jail. But I do mean that it should be the law of the land because we need in our laws to state what is wrong, and there should be some kind of consequence. But I understand that a lot of women do this innocently, not knowing what they're doing. No, I don't want to see them in jail, but how a jury punishes and what should be the law, in my mind, are two separate things. All right, just to say, I'm not trying to tell anybody, don't worry, you can still have your abortion. I am instead simply being factual because it's a fact that the left wants to ignore. And the left is really good at ignoring facts. And the left wants you to be too stupid to know the facts. The Democrats, hoping to make this an issue for November midterms, are talking as if abortion was just made illegal in the entire country. It ought to be, but it isn't. Just being factual, because you won't hear many facts from the left. Facts get in the way of their talking points, which leads to the next lie. Lie. The Supreme Court is not supposed to overturn legal precedent. All right, here the idea is that Roe versus Wade was the law of the land, so it should never have been overturned. My friends, the law of the land in terms of actual laws that we truly made as American citizens was that abortion prior to 1973 was being regulated differently depending on what state you lived in. 30 states, the high majority of states, said abortion was against the law. That was the law of the land, or at least the law of much of our land. That was overturned by just a handful of justices, a power the Supreme Court was never intended to execute. What has happened recently is the reversal of a bad ruling, a recognition that they had no right to execute that. Yes, that ruling was a precedent. Roe v. Wade was precedent. So was the Dred Scott decision upholding a slaveholder's rights. You want to tell me that should never have been reversed? The next lie. The left cares about the privacy of a human body. No, they don't. No, they don't. If they did, they wouldn't be forcing people to take vaccines or even to wear masks, because that goes on your body. And of course, do I really need to say it again? The baby inside the womb is a body too. Do they care about that body? The next lie, a common one, you've heard this before, lie. Christians should not legislate from the Bible. What a crock of bull. My friend, all laws are based upon someone's standard of morality. If it isn't the Christian standard, it's the standard of another religion. If it isn't the standard of another religion, it will be the standard of the humanist, or the socialist, or the communist, or the atheist. If we are really a democratic republic, and I'm saying this as somebody who does not want to force Christianity on anybody else, but if we are really a democratic republic, a place where citizens are allowed to vote, we are allowed to vote our conscience. And if our conscience believes we should apply the Bible, so be it. Now you're thinking, but Bob, what about separation between church and state? No such words are found in our Constitution. What we read instead is a First Amendment, which says, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of a religion or prohibiting the free speech thereof. Telling people they cannot speak about the Bible outside of a church building, or telling people that they cannot vote based on their religious views, is something an awful lot like prohibiting the free speech thereof, isn't it? Now, having said that, and let me phrase this as carefully as I can, I do think my fellow Christians would make better headway in their conversations if they appealed to common ground when seeking to establish good law. By common ground, I return to a word I just used in passing a moment ago, the conscience. According to the Bible, God's standards are found in the human conscience. You don't have to read the Bible. You don't even have to believe in the Bible to have the standards of the Bible. It's inside of us already. Ironically, even those who claim not to believe in God still operate with God's standards. That is, they feel guilt when they don't do the right thing. It comes from the conscience, an inner witness giving commentary on human thoughts and decisions. Oh, we may not live up to these standards, but the standards are there. Well, it is true that we can find scripture condemning abortion. The tiresome quoting of Bible verses to people who do not believe in the Bible accomplishes nothing, absolutely nothing, and mistakenly gives out the signal that we are here to force our religion on others. We are not. I am not. And so, when someone asks me why abortion is wrong, I don't say, because the Bible tells me God created that baby in the womb and the baby has a soul. Now, that's the truth. That would be a factual answer, but that's not what I say. What I say is just as true, but much more easily comprehended. I say the baby is a human life. You don't have to be religious to know that the taking of a human life is wrong. Our society already condemns murder. There are many atheists who speak out against abortion. Why? Because it's wrong. And they don't need a Bible to tell them it's wrong. They have their conscience. And everybody has the same conscience. Notice how pro-choice people, when they demonstrate, will ignore the conscience and constantly frame their argument in terms of contraceptives. I have nothing against contraceptives, and I would never support a law that prohibited contraceptive. But that's not the issue, my friend. There is another human life inside. That's not even debatable anymore, not according to science. And even back when people thought it was debatable, nobody wanted to debate it. All they did was talk about contraceptive and ignore the more prominent, important issue. Once we agree that the fetus is a life, we know what to do and we know what not to do. But even then, the conscience can be ignored. Humans are notorious for ignoring it. They'll say, well, okay, sure, it's a life, but it's not a quality of life. Of course, naturally, the goalpost constantly gets moved when there is something a person wants to believe. Speaking of lies, I want to point out this next lie in the form of an irony. Why is it that the break-in of the Capitol building on January 6th was considered insurrection, but calling for the abolishment of our third branch of government is not insurrection? Yes, some people are calling for the abolishment of the Supreme Court. Others are calling for the death of the justices who made the ruling. Others are simply saying we should go to their homes for protest and intimidation. That's against the law. It's against the law to protest on the property of a judge ruling on a case. You ask me, it should be against the law to protest on anybody's private property, but it's at least against the law to protest on a judge's property, and yet such protests are being encouraged. Why isn't that considered insurrection? One of the protesters' signs that I saw in the news said, "Abort the Supreme Court." And so I ask you again, why isn't that considered insurrection? Well, for one thing, it's actually being encouraged by our elected officials in Congress. Maxine Waters says, and I quote, "Women are going to control their bodies no matter how they try to stop us. The hell with the Supreme Court. We will defy them. A branch of our government will be defied." If a Trump supporter said something like that, they'd be talking about putting him in jail. Speaking of Trump supporters, and speaking of this same Maxine Waters, in the past, she has encouraged in-your-face protest for anyone related to the Trump administration. Here's a quote from back then. "Let's make sure we show up wherever we have to show up. And if you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gas station, you get out and you create a crowd and you push back on them and you tell them they're not welcome." Those are the words of an elected Congresswoman, Maxine Waters. Isn't that nice? What a sweetheart. This from the party of tolerance. This from the party of inclusion. And then, when such protests turn violent, we hear from the left that it's only democracy in action. Meanwhile, mere words, mere spoken words of challenge from conservatives are called the real violence. Catching on? Violence is peaceful protest. Mere words are the real violence if they're not woke or politically correct. Let's be clear, shouting somebody down while they are trying to talk is not using your own First Amendment right. Neither is harassing somebody in a restaurant or refusing them service simply because you do not care for their politics. And of course, that also goes for vandalism, that also goes for violence. All of these, however, are being touted as people's free speech rights to be heard in a democracy. In point of fact, such actions do nothing even close to embracing the ideal of free speech. They are designed designed to intimidate. They are designed to suppress free speech. They are used by people too cowardly to engage in civil debate, people who are aware that their ideas are often indefensible, so they don't try to debate. Instead, they shut down debate. They don't allow debate. Another lie. Abortion is a man versus women's issue. My friends, most of the leaders in the pro-life movement are women, not men, women. Nevertheless, as a man, I too am against abortion. Who am I to dare assert my opinion on this issue as a man? Who do I have to be? Who do I have to be? As it happens, I as a man do believe in the rights of all women, including baby women. Nevertheless, this will still be couched as an issue that is entirely about women's rights. Fine. Yeah, fine. I suppose there is one silver lining in doing it that way. Really, there is. Are you catching the good news? Are you seeing the grand picture here? It seems the left is able to define and identify women. Once again, only recently, one of our liberal Supreme Court nominees was unable to do that. Of course, all of this should be obvious, but we are living in stupid, mind-numbing times, so it is time, once again, to make the obvious obvious.
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
My readers and listeners sent the following question, and I'm sure it's one that many of us, probably all of us, have asked at one time or another. Bob, the Bible teaches salvation and ongoing sanctification through grace. We are taught to be open about our weaknesses and inability to handle this world on our own. For example, the book of James. I'm humbled and confused when I read about the heroes of the Protestant Reformation my daughter is learning about. Huss, Tyndale, and many others risked their lives, and many were burned at the stake for daring to assert the word over the Pope. If God hasn't given us the courage and boldness today to do what they did, we don't need to sweat it, right? The reason these men were able to do what they did was by God's strength. If God hasn't given us that strength yet, then we are off the hook, right? In other words, we can't rejoice in Jesus' statement of the repentant thief on the cross and then 2 seconds later expect ourselves to manufacture the courage to be another Martin Luther or Dietrich Bonhoeffer, right? Another way I could have asked the courage question is whether we can blame God for our failings. Imagine if I'm put in a situation where I need to stand up for my faith. If I fail, couldn't I say, I'm saved by grace and God didn't give me the needed courage, so it isn't my fault? All right, very interesting question, my friend, and thank you, first of all, for the honesty and the humility that it took to write it. I'm sure all of us at times ponder the future and wonder if we would be able to do the right thing when put to the test. Had Simon Peter given this subject more attention in prayer, he would not have found himself denying Jesus, something he was certain he could never do. On the other hand, after receiving the Holy Spirit, Peter did take courageous stands the rest of his life, although even with the Holy Spirit, he had to learn to focus on it because there was another time where he wavered and was challenged by the Apostle Paul for compromising. But ultimately, Peter did depend on this Spirit. He took many courageous stands and was crucified ultimately by Emperor Nero for his Christian faith. In fact, church tradition tells us Peter insisted on being crucified upside down because he considered it too much of an honor to be crucified right side up like his Lord. I agree that God must give us the strength. All people get frightened. A courageous person isn't a person who never gets frightened. It's one who admits that he is afraid, but does the right thing anyway. Sometimes that's simply impossible apart from God, especially if we are putting our lives on the line. The Bible does promise that God will never allow us to be tempted beyond our ability to endure. 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. Usually when we think of temptation, we think in terms of being tempted to do something pleasurable or sexual, something like that. But capitulation in the midst of torture to stop the torture is technically a temptation as well. So this verse does apply. Therefore, we can assume that people who are called to die or suffer for Christ have been made ready. That is a significant wrinkle in this discussion. If you find yourself in a trying situation, it will mean God has decided you can handle it. Maybe if it happened today, you couldn't handle it, but it's not happening today. If it happens at all, it will happen in the future after God has worked in your life, after God has prepared you. The strength to get through and the nurture of His Spirit will be available whether it immediately seems that way or not. Hang in there, my friend, and keep the faith.
This is Bob Siegel. With the wiring in your home, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. For all you know, he may have gotten his license by sending in 3 serial box tops.
Hey, these things happen. There's nothing wrong with my wiring. Houses burned down. You wanted a guarantee? You should have ordered the deluxe package.
Folks, play it smart. Call WNS Electric Incorporated. They specialize in contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, WNS takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I use them myself, and I wouldn't call anyone else. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for WNS Electric, license number 480539, WNS Electric.
People are enjoying Bob Siegel's time travel novel, Push the Winds Around. Check out these customer reviews on Amazon.com. This is one of those books like certain movies where you keep thinking about it long after you finished. Once I picked it up, I didn't want to put it down until I'd read the entire book, literally a page-turner. every character came to life. Their personalities were well-defined and consistent. First thing I did after I finished the book was to ask about the sequel. The next customer said, "I read this book cover to cover in one sitting. Great read with completely unexpected ending that left me wishing there was just one more chapter. Give yourself a couple of hours to read it all at once because you won't want to put it down." Push the Winds Around, available on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
Been discussing the idea of exceptions regarding the command to consciously accept Jesus as Lord and Savior. For example, if a baby dies, naturally a baby does not get sent to hell by a loving God. That should be extremely obvious. We shouldn't even have to discuss that one. And yet, people pose the question all the time. Entire denominations baptize infants. And yes, there are different churches who have different reasons for doing this. But the practice years ago began out of a genuine fear that an unbaptized baby would be sent to hell. So I have addressed this over the air by pointing to a Bible passage which went out of its way to say the obvious, that little children have no knowledge of good and evil. You can find that in the first chapter of Deuteronomy. We have also looked at a verse, and I've explored this in great detail, which says that prior to the coming of Christ and the spreading of the gospel, God overlooked sincere ignorance. We read that in Acts chapter 17 when the apostle Paul was in Athens. Now, I added carefully that I believe this would also apply to any culture today. I believe that. The Bible doesn't explicitly say that, but I believe that. I extrapolate that from Acts 17, that God would apply that to a culture today that never heard of Jesus. Not that ignorance would be an automatic ticket into heaven. Instead, God, who knows our hearts, is able to judge us according to what he knows we would have done if we had heard. He will apparently make this call based upon how we responded to our own conscience. Romans chapter 2. When we were convicted of sin, did we cry out to whatever God might be out there seeking his mercy, or did we ignore our conscience and rationalize our actions? In the Gospel of Luke, Jesus tells a parable about a man who beat his chest and said, "God, have mercy on me, a sinner." Jesus says that man was justified, forgiven. And of course, he said that to an audience that did not yet understand that he was going to go to the cross and die for their sins, but this still seemed to be the bottom line. Regardless of how much enlightenment we have, regardless of how much theology we have or knowledge, if we understand that we're sinful and we cry out to whatever God is out there, that seems to be enough. Well, I remember a time when toward the end of one of these discussions over the air, we got a phone call, and our caller, finding the topic very interesting, presented a new wrinkle. He asked about the person who did hear the gospel, but just wasn't convinced it was true. I gave a very quick answer because we were out of time and I only had time for a very quick answer. Of course, I wished I'd had more time to offer a careful, detailed explanation, which was certainly warranted by such a serious subject. And so, over the air, 1 week later, I explored his question again with detail, with the appropriate expansion. And since this has come up again so much recently on my radio shows and podcasts, I thought I would look at this question again, because it's certainly a subject worthy of being revisited. My friends, God is concerned about the reason a person turns away from Christ's forgiveness. If they are turning away because they would rather live a life of sin, this is the core problem. If anybody knows, or at least strongly suspects, that Jesus is real, but they push him away for selfish, sinful reasons, that person will not spend eternity with God. On this matter, the Bible is abundantly clear. Now, Keeping that in mind, how does God feel about skeptics? Well, if they are sincere skeptics, he has no problem. Paul sincerely did not believe in Jesus, but Jesus nevertheless revealed himself to Paul, and then, of course, Paul did accept him. Thomas, one of the disciples, had doubts that Jesus had risen from the dead. He wasn't there when Jesus appeared to the others, but Jesus appeared to Thomas, and then Thomas did believe. You see, removing honest doubt is very easy for God. The barrier between God and man is sin, not doubt. However, and it's a significant however, there is also such a thing as an insincere skeptic. My friend, maybe you are not convinced, but let me say, just as the apostles said, you can seek God through prayer. You can examine the historicity of the resurrection. You can examine the accuracy of the Bible and the fulfillment of Bible prophecy. If somebody has been challenged, but they ignore the challenge, yes, they may stand before God on Judgment Day and say, God, I was never absolutely sure that this was true. But then God will say to them, why didn't you make yourself absolutely sure? Why did you not take the time to pray, study, seek? Was it because you did not want to believe this was true? So yes, God will tolerate a sincere skeptic, but on Judgment Day, people and God will have a little discussion about how sincere or insincere their skepticism truly was. Make no mistake, the decision to deliberately refrain from seeking Christ for the reason that one would rather live a life of sin is the same as the decision to reject Christ after fuller knowledge. Could there be other things that hinder a person from seeking, such as hypocrisy in the church, for example? Yes, of course. All I'm saying is people should not play games. As human beings, we have an incredible ability to rationalize. God himself will not be fooled. One thing is certain, we will all stand before God someday and answer for the lives we lived. If somebody is hearing a message about how this God reached out to them, wanting to forgive them, if only they would serve him, and they choose to ignore the message rather than taking the time to investigate, there will be some accountability. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
The sequel to The Dangerous Christmas Ornament is called Inside the Castle in the Glass, and already this entertaining sequel is getting great reviews from customers on Amazon.com. Reviews such as this one. Very clever way of introducing certain life principles in a fictional setting. I thoroughly enjoyed the story. Here's another review. I picked up this book at a book signing with Bob Siegel on a Friday. By Monday morning before work, I finished it. This is over 500 pages of story. I couldn't put it down. I would plan to put it down at the end of the chapter, then something big would take place. I would have to continue to see what happened. A lot of unexpected twists and turns and a lot of things you can't imagine. Things that make you say, what? By the way, I am pushing 60 years old and I enjoyed this book and look forward to more of Bob's books. Keep them coming. Inside the Castle in the Glass, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Thank you.
Welcome back to 1170 AM, 96.1 FM, The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Well, we're here with producer Brendan Thomas to give us part two of his movie reviews. I know some of you are waiting with bated breath. Not just any old movies. These are Christian films, either films that were designed to be Christian and promoted in churches, or major Hollywood releases that happen to have Christian or biblical themes. So let's take us back to where you left off, Brendan.
Absolutely. Well, first, I want to say happy birthday to the United States of America. They are turning 246 because obviously it is Independence Day. Although my kids keep saying, no, it's 4th of July. I prefer the term Independence Day.
Well, that's what the real 4th of July just happens to be the date. That's changing the name of Christmas to December 20th. The 25th.
Yeah. I don't like that. I like calling it Christmas. I like calling it Independence Day. I'm not going to call Labor Day September 1st.
Well, we're used to saying 4th of July. We used to have a joke when we were kids. Do they have the 4th of July in England? And the answer was, yeah, they do. They just don't celebrate it.
So. I like that joke. I've never heard that one.
Yeah, but it just shows how much we're used to saying 4th of July rather than Independence Day.
No, I like that. I have to use that one.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So we are going to continue on our list of, currently I'm in the top 10 best Christian films of all time. And like you've stated earlier, either these were promoted in churches or these were Hollywood big blockbuster ones. So we are currently at number 6. And coming at number 6 for me is the third series in the God's Not Dead quadrilogy, because there's four of them. God's Not Dead, A Light in Darkness. This one surprised me.
I didn't
honestly.
See this one. I did not see. I saw the first two.
Yeah, this one definitely surprised me. I have to say, there's really good acting from David A.R. White and his brother John Cree. I think
is it name. Mostly the same characters from the first two movies?
Yeah, well, actually, so now we have.
They added some new ones.
No. They have the Asian one, the Asian student who was disowned by his father.
Oh,
in the
I remember
first
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's back in the third one.
Oh,
now,
okay.
And they actually give him a lot more character time because I felt like he was quickly shoved in at the last second. I felt like in the first one. In this one, you get a lot more character. You get a lot more reason why he decided to go into Christianity. And it really does make him a more believable and a more relatable character for that reason. So I appreciate that. But like I said, what I really do appreciate is the main focus of the film follows David A.R. White. He is trying to deal with a lot of personal issues. He's also questioning his own faith in this matter too. And he has an estranged brother, and his estranged brother is strictly atheist. He's like, I don't believe in a second. And David A.R. White knows, okay, there's no way I'll convert this guy, but I still want to have a relationship with my brother. And so we really focus in on all the things that happened as a kid and them trying to regrow and repatch their relationship. And I really, really appreciate that. And there's some other subplots in here that, again, make David A.R. White really, really just a really good actor. And I think he's truly one of the most underappreciated actors right now as we speak. He can give some performances that could be sometimes forgettable. For the most part, he's always the best part in every film.
Well, I like the idea of somebody saying, instead of trying to convert, I'm just going to patch my relationship. Because sometimes that could do more toward a genuine conversion anyway, because they're demonstrating the love of Christ.
A little tiny but they don't state that he converts his brother, but his brother does get
but it was still time well spent.
Exactly.
Yes.
At the end of the movie, David A.R. White sends over his brother a Bible and he smiles at it. So it doesn't state that he converts his brother, but it's still.
Well, they need to leave something for the fourth movie.
I know,
so
right?
They can make more money.
Exactly. But honestly, I'm surprised that a lot of I read some Christian outlets too that kind of disowned, saying this isn't a really good Christian film. I think honestly, it really was a good Christian film. It would have never converted anybody to Christianity. But
is that why they were complaining about
exactly,
it?
Exactly. Yeah, because the first two were really trying hard to convert atheist people to Christianity. This one mostly focuses on a character-driven
story.
As
long as the truth is stated in there. You know, it's not always a happy ending. Not everybody does convert. So I don't see why anybody should take issue with
that. I know. So it does surprise me a bit. Coming in at number 5, we have discussed this movie before already, so I won't go into too much details. It's The Robe. Thank you again for
the
recommendation.
We spent a whole show on it. You can go to my podcast list and find a whole show on The Robe.
Exactly, yeah. So again, it's a really fantastic movie, and I think it's also very historically, in terms of both filmmaking and for religious purposes, I think everyone should still watch it still. It is very, very well made, and again, if you want more details, just go to the podcast for
sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Coming in at number 4 is I'm Not Ashamed. Unchained. Have you seen this one before?
It's sounding familiar, but honestly, Brendan, I can't remember at this moment if I've seen it or not.
So this film is a very, very dark film in terms of the actual subject matter. It has to do with the Columbine shooting and one of the first people to be shot.
Okay, I did not see this.
Yeah. So this was made, again, by PureFlix, but I thought it was really, really well done. I didn't like Sadie Robertson, who is part of the Duck Dynasty crew. She's the daughter. She plays the girl who got shot's best friend. Her acting's not very
good. Yeah, that was
good.
The big thing about the Columbine, the heroic Christian woman that got shot and killed for
being a
Christian.
Yeah, they said, do you still believe in God?
And she said, yes.
Yes, exactly.
And then he said something like, well, then why won't he save you right now? And then he shot her.
Yes, and they do the entire movie really, really well, honestly. Again, this film did come with some criticism where people were very ashamed that, oh, you're just cashing in on this whole situation. But I disagree entirely. I think it's a very touching film.
Well, motive is important. If somebody was trying to exploit a tragedy, that is an issue. But the other side of that is we can't always look into a person's heart and motives.
Mm-hmm.
And if they say they weren't trying to exploit it, but they just wanted to make a good film, then we should just take them at their word.
And the parents of the daughters actually helped produce the movie,
okay,
too.
And they wouldn't have gone along with people that wanted to exploit it.
Exactly. And they gave the whole blessing of the film and everything.
Well, there you have it. There's your answer right there.
And again, exactly. So in my opinion, I think people should check out I'm Not Ashamed. Yes, it does deal with some details, obviously, the shooting and everything. But at the same token, you get to relate to this person a lot. Like, she's not just like, you know, some Hollywood writer. Oh, let's see what teenage girls like. She actually acts like a teenage girl. She will do things that most teenagers will do that you will say, oh, well, you shouldn't be doing that, but you're going to learn from your mistakes, sort of thing. So I really appreciated that part of the movie. And again, if you have not seen it, definitely check it out wherever you can. Coming in at number three, everyone knows this is a classic. Ben-Hur is coming in at number
three. Yeah, and I would probably put that, as far as biblical movies go, I would put that on the very top.
Oh, it's the best.
For me, yeah. Okay. I loved The Robe. I would put Ben-Hur a notch above The Robe. Even.
Oh, I get it. But the other two are coming up, I'm going to defend a little bit more.
Okay.
But Ben-Hur is nothing to complain about at all. It is literally
and
a
it was
perfect.
For the longest time, it held the record, 11 Academy Awards. Mm-hmm. And that was broken by Titanic, which was
and don't get
not
me
one of my favorites.
And then don't get me started on the whole chariot racing scene. That's another thing that's spectacular time.
You know, I got to meet Charlton Heston when the AMC 20 opened here in San Diego in Mission Valley.
Huh.
They opened it by showing a different Charlton Heston movie on every screen, and they staggered the time so that Charlton Heston came out for 10 minutes before the movie, gave a little talk, took a few questions from the audience, and they had Planet of the Apes, and they had the Ten Commandments, and they had the Omega Man. I went, of course, to see Ben-Hur. It was a terrible print of the movie.
Oh, no.
Because it was all scratchy, but still, I was seeing it on the big screen for the first time, and he told a story about that chariot race, because obviously he didn't do all of his own stunts, but he wanted to do some of them. So he was riding in that chariot.
Yes.
And the guy that was training him saw how apprehensive he was. And he finally said, Charlton, you really have nothing to worry about. I guarantee you're going to win the darn race. I'm saying darn because I'm on the radio.
No, yes.
That's, of course, Heston had a book that had just come out, and I got a signed copy of that too. So that was a thrill. He's always been one of my favorite actors, and to go and meet him and see him introducing one of my favorite movies, it was a great evening.
And man, you had to think of like which movie do you have to choose to see Charles Heston in? I mean,
yeah, like because said, most of the others that were playing on the big screen I also liked,
but
I had to put Ben-Hur on the top.
Personally, if I had to rate those, I would go Planet of the Apes slightly above Ben-Hur for me.
Oh, I loved the Planet. I didn't feel that great about all the dumb sequels they made, but the original Planet of the Apes. And you know who wrote the screenplay for it? Not the original novel. The original novel was written by Pierre Boulez, who wrote Bridge on the River Kwai.
Yes.
But the screenplay for the film Planet of the Apes was written by Rod Serling, one of your favorites from Zone.
Yes, right. Yeah. And again, I love the ending, too. It's really
which is different
iconic.
Than the book.
Because
he goes back to Earth, and he really had been on another planet. But when he gets to Earth, he founds them taken over by apes as well. Serling made it, you know, the famous Statue of Liberty scene, and he really was on Earth. I actually liked the film's ending better, which I don't usually say. I'm usually a bigger fan of the book than
the
movie.
I know exactly what you mean.
But it was such a biting ending. And just at the end when the credits were rolling and you hear the ocean. in the back and all that has happened, but only the ocean is still there. It was just really eerie and extremely effective.
Yeah, absolutely. So coming in number two is the Ten Commandments, which we were just
talking
about.
I love the Ten Commandments.
Yeah. I mean, you have an all-star cast. Charlton Heston, Vincent Price, Cedric Hardwick, Edward Robinson, Deborah Padgett. This is an all-star
And don't forget
cast
Yul Brynner. And Yul Brynner won the Academy Award that year for a movie nominated for Best Picture opposite The Ten Commandments, and that was The King and I.
Yeah.
So that was a big year for Yul Brynner.
Yeah. And again, if you have not seen Ten Commandments, this is one of the – this is legitimately the best – almost the best biblical film, because I do have a number one.
Well, they had that spectacular parting of the Red Sea, and this is long before CGI. You've really got to hand it to them.
I know. The amount of work they put in, and I can't imagine like how much the movie cost at the time.
Do you know how they did that scene, by the way?
How did they do it?
That was another thing that Heston's gone around and explained. They took a box of Jell-O, and they melted it, and then ran the film backwards, and it... I'm sure they found other ways to enhance that, but that's what I've heard is the explanation for that.
It almost sounds like The Blob from back in the 1960s or 70s. It was just Jell-O, basically.
But it looked,
filmed it backwards,
yeah,
too. So.
But that parting of the Red Sea looked fantastic, and it did win a special achievement in a special effects award.
That's interesting. Okay. Coming in at number one for me is The Prince of Egypt, personally. So
I liked that version, too. And the music was beautiful, written by the same team that did Godspell, which we talked about last week.
Yes.
They're a great composer.
Absolutely. The animation's really good. I love looking into the relationship between Moses and his brother. When we were talking about the Red Sea parting, yes, it is CGI and animated, but that's still really, really well done. And I also, one very small little detail I definitely liked compared to the Ten Commandments, is I like how, remember when they were able to change the sticks into the snakes? In the original Ten Commandments, they were able to do it through Satan's power, supposedly. But in the Prince of Egypt, they use a lot of smoke and mirrors. So you can't really tell if they were able to just quickly...
Oh, I didn't remember that. They made it look like it might have been fakery.
Exactly, yeah. So I like that a little bit more. But
well, biblically, though, the magicians really did do it by some kind of satanic magic.
Right, but I'm talking about in a Hollywood
sense. In
the
Hollywood sense, yes. I could see why they did that. They wanted to make it clear this was the real miracle and this was the fake.
Of course, I wasn't a huge fan of Jeff Goldblum voice in a character. That was my Jeff Goldblum impression.
Which one did Goldblum voice?
He plays Moses' brother, I believe, in the film, if I remember.
Oh, he played the part of Aaron in there?
Yes.
It's been years since I've seen Prince.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful song, that miracle song. I have played that on the radio. We should, in a future week, just play that again. I've played that all the way through.
I wouldn't complain that for a second, yes. And we've done the Burning Bush song, too, that goes along with when Moses first meets the Burning Bush, which also fantastically animated on that part, too. So I got no complaints, really, besides a couple of the voice acting. Like, again, the magicians that we were talking about earlier, they're voiced by Steve Martin and Martin Short. And I'm like,
they are good comedians, though. But we have to give this disclaimer with any movie based on the Bible, like with most movies, the book is better.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. And in this sense, yes, the book is better for sure. But again, I appreciate the imaginative direction they were going with.
I did like that movie a lot.
Yeah. All right. So now with the top 10 best Christian films out of the way, we're going to go to the top 10 worst Christian films.
Now, I asked you at the end of last week's show about The War Room. Did you not like The War Room, or did it just not make you...
It's going in the worst, unfortunately.
Oh, my
goodness. I will get to it. I will get to it, and we can discuss it from that point.
I am surprised. I'm very surprised.
Yeah. So let me go through some dishonorable mentions.
Just a minute, I'm crossing you off my will here. I'll be back with you in a second.
No problem. One of the dishonorable mentions is Mom's Night Out. I don't know if you've seen that one.
Never saw that.
So she's part of this Bible reading group, and she's dealing with so much stress.
Oh, wait. I did see that, now that you mention it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was more like, I think you
didn't
need
it star the woman that was in Raymond, the sitcom Raymond,
yes,
she had played Raymond's.
So.
Well, yeah,
Trace Atkins is in it too as a bicycle. Like you think he's going to be a really tough guy, but he does the joke of a really wimpy.
I saw it so long ago that I honestly don't remember whether I liked it or not. So I'll just go with you since I can't remember.
I'm just saying, I think the mom needs therapy, possibly, maybe some kind of like. Because she is panicking beyond, she's having panic attacks. I don't think a night on the town's going to help too much to get away from the kids and everything.
Anyone that thinks one night on the town's going to make up for a whole lifetime of problems.
No, definitely not. Have you seen Little Boy ever?
No.
Okay. So that one's about a little boy who lives on an island just off the coast of California. And this is the same time as World War II in Japan. And the movie focuses on the little boy's interaction with a Japanese family. And they're actually being kind of excluded in the community because of World War II going on.
So this island is in American territory.
Correct. Yes, yes. And the Japanese family were immigrants at the time already. And so they're being mistreated. And the little boy's trying to figure out why is that and everything. It's very, very mean.
Is it
honestly
supposed to be based on a true story, or is it
apparently
fiction?
So?
Other than Catalina, I wasn't aware of too many populated islands. I mean, we have tons of islands off the coast of California.
I have to look it up again.
I wasn't aware of any other than Catalina that are even populated. But what do I know? I suppose there is.
So this is also based on Little Boy is also the nickname of one of the atomic bombs that dropped on Hiroshima.
Oh
too.
Yeah, Fat Man and Little Boy were the two names that one on Hiroshima, one on Nagasaki.
And they have like this one line that they had to force in there that nobody would ever say. It's like, you're going to become really famous one day, little boy. And I was like, don't say that.
As if anybody ahead of time would have known about that.
Yes. I have God's Not Dead 2 on here as a dishonorable mention. Very, very beginning of the film, Pat Boone is in the movie. He plays Melissa Joan Hart's grandfather, if I remember right. She's taking care of her grandfather at home. And he says a really, really mean-spirited comment. And that automatically made me feel like, man, this movie's not going to
be. I don't remember that. What was
the comment? Was, that's the thing about atheism. It never gives you hope. And I was like, that's kind of mean-spirited to say as a Christian, I feel like.
I think that's a true statement. I guess it would depend on the way it was said in the context.
So in this case, she finds out at this point, oh, I'm getting sued over the family for making this comment. And the comment was, she was teaching about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And a student asks, is that related to how Jesus said in Scripture? And she quotes Scripture. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. She's not trying to convert the kids or anything. She's just quoting them as a historical factor. And automatically a kid hears about it, texts the principal, and the school immediately fires her and sues her for trying to convert students.
Well, there have been schools that have fired people for less than that. So that
especially that Seattle prayer thing, but luckily that's
so
changed.
That's actually very true to life. And I know that at the end of that movie, they listed all kinds of real cases in the credits.
Yes. It's similar to the first God's Not Dead. If you've seen the first one, you already know what you're going to experience through the second one. So you just got to go in with that.
And like I said, it was very mixed for me. Well-written dialogue, not so well-written dialogue. To me, it was a real mixture, both of those movies.
Right. I think my favorite character personally, because he plays it over the top beyond belief, is Ray Wise. He plays the attorney for... I'm trying to remember. Is it the NC? No, not the NC.
Who? It was the pastor in that movie that had an attorney, wasn't it?
No. He was represented by another corporation or government figure. I'm trying to remember what they were called now. I got to look that up again. But this government figure, if you look it up through the history, they've also done religious cases too, where they actually defended religious organizations. So I'm kind of mixed on the message of the film trying to tell me here. So that's one of the other dishonorable mentions. And unfortunately, guess what? What, Bob? We've already ran out of time already.
You're not
going to
run
10.
Out of time at the War Room again. You got to tell me quickly why you didn't like the War Room.
Very quickly. I'm just going to say that is nothing more than you just need marriage counseling. The husband shouldn't say, you need to apologize to me for the way you treat me. That's one of the scenes. They also are so mean-spirited to the wife. Like, oh, what is that? Your feet smell? Oh, you look awful. You look sweaty and disgusting. I'm like, man, come on.
But I thought the older woman that was mentoring the younger one and teaching her the power of prayer, that to me what really came through was the power of persistent prayer.
That's what the war room was, the prayer room. I have to say, I laughed hysterically at the scene where they're in the parking garage and the guy's like, give me your money. And she goes, no, you back off. And that scares the robber away. I'm laughing hysterically. What? But that's, well, again, I'll discuss way more of that in another part of the series. So, yes.
Thank you so much, we agreed again on a lot of them.
Yes, exactly. Thank you again so much. And again, happy Independence Day to everybody as well. And thank you again, Bob, for letting me be on the air with you again.
I love having you on the air, Brendan. You do a great job. You have a great radio voice. Okay, we will see you next time. As always, this is Bob Siegel, making the obvious obvious.
Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the law offices of Matthew Simone.